Bonjour. Alors, je pense qu'on va commencer. Welcome. Bienvenue. Je m'appelle Ali Martin-Mayer. Je suis la doyenne adjointe en charge de l'admission et du recrutement à la Faculté de droit de l'Université McGill. Je vous souhaite la plus cordiale des bienvenues à cette première séance d'information ou atelier pour repostulant. Pour votre information, j'ai inventé le mot repostulant parce que j'ai trouvé aucun équivalent en français pour le mot reapplicant. So welcome to this workshop. It will take place a little bit in French and in English. I wanted to just tell you this is the first time we have a reapplicant workshop. And the reason we decided to try this year is that when we've met with candidates who are looking to reapply, a lot of the same questions were coming up and up and up, and I was giving feedback that the same points over and over again. So I thought it might be more efficient and more transparent to just give that very detailed general information to everyone. And for your information, the session is being filmed as well. And so that we can put it online. And I think it might affect the number of people who chose to come since the information will be available otherwise. Because it is being filmed, we will go through kind of the main presentation, and we will keep the questions until the end, with the exception of questions that will be targeted to our student ambassador, who will be talking first to you, and then he can take some questions that are relevant to the student experience or the candidate experience, and then I will go into the whole explanation of the process. Well, you'll see how different this presentation is from the general admissions information session, and then we will have a Q&A. And for the questions, it's not a big group, so I could probably manage taking them directly from you, but I want to make sure that I repeat the question because it needs to be taped for the answer to make sense, obviously. So we will be working with the little yellow sheets. So this is just housekeeping stuff. Okay, so I'll be doing most of the talking. But first, you'll hear from a student ambassador. I'll introduce him in 1 second. And the third person with us today is Lindsay Flood, who's right here. Lindsay is admissions coordinator. So she's the one who answers all of the frontline questions if you contact the office, if you send an email. So Lindsay's your girl. She will be also helping me coordinate with the questions and collecting the surveys, the green sheets at the end of the session. So here's the agenda for today. So first we will hear from Vincent, who's a student in second year and who is also a successful reapplicant. Then we will talk, you might have seen this on the website, we will talk about the reality of admissions to McGill Law. We will talk about what your refusal letter was saying. We will go into detail to decode that information together. We will, and this, like points 1 and 2 are more, I guess, trying to put context to why you're here. Points 3 and 4 are more like looking backwards at your first application and your refusal and trying to get as much information from that as you can. And then points 5, 6, and 7 are looking forward. What do you do or what do you avoid doing when you're thinking of reapplying? And obviously the Q&A period is also geared towards reapplication. So this is the agenda for today. It should take us hopefully maybe just over an hour for the first 6 points, and then hopefully enough time to answer all of your questions. And I will give the floor to Vincent.
So hi everyone, just like Martin Maillet just said, I'm in my second year now at McGill. And as most of you, I believe, I was saddened when I got the news I was refused to McGill Law. And my first thought was maybe, well, they made a mistake in my file. Well, I applied right from CJAP, and I had good grades there. I had a good extracurriculum activities, and I put a lot of time and effort in my application. So, of course, I was a bit disappointed that not being accepted at first. But, you know, after a couple of weeks, I realized, well, it might be good for me at the long term. And I wanted to study at McGill Law for the past 5 years or so before my application. And when I put the things in perspective, I decided to do an undergrad degree in political science and Hispanic literature at McGill, although I was accepted at another law faculty in Montreal. But I decided myself it would be better to go at McGill, stay at McGill, and I knew that the background in another field would just be a good experience for me in the future. In my undergrad, I had the chance to plan my next application over a long period of time, and I took the time and effort to participate actively in some of my classes that I am more interested in. Out of that, I was able to meet with some professors that were actually, some of them made some nice reference letter for my future applications. And I still contact them now and then. However, it was not until I was accepted at McGill Law that I actually realized and I fully understood why I was not accepted at first. And also that I came to realize the benefits of my experience in the past few years before the application, well, my successful application. Anyone here accepted has a story, an experience, or a background that make him or her special. And this is one of the, well, beauty of being in this program. You will learn a lot from your colleagues. I had some colleagues with background in child psychology that were just able to challenge any foundations of parents' strict liability for their children's wrong. I had other colleagues with philosophy backgrounds revealing the flaws of analogical reasoning that the prof never actually even heard before. And believe me, our profs here are very qualified. And as a personal note, I was able to rely on my political science background in many classes. Well, with all that, what I intend to say is that your extra years before successfully being accepted to law school here are not going to be wasted years. Either at the university, if you're on a work market, any good experience is just going to be good for you in the long term. And for example, I came from CEGEP, and some of you come from CEGEP, maybe it will be an opportunity for you to familiarize yourself with the university workloads, with the exam, the assignments, how the university works in itself. And believe me, it's different than CEGEP. If you already have another degree, well, it might be a good opportunity for you to experience the job market. I know some of my colleagues are actually, they worked for a couple of years before coming to law school. Some of theirs have some graduate studies, masters, PhDs. So anything that you can do before law school could be a good experience. And, well, if you are still 1 year or 2 years short of having a degree, it might just be good to finish it and actually have a plus for some future employers in the long run. So in short, my main point would be for you, like, do not see this refusal as a failure or a sign that you're not a competent and smart student. It's not the case. It's just an opportunity to acquire useful experience prior to legal studies. And don't be ashamed. Nobody will know if you're a reapplicant or not. And I know Mathemaye will go over the stats in the future. Coming out of CEGEP or other places, it's not easy to get into McGill. And just as the slide said, 7 out of 8 applicants are refused here. So there's no shame in reapplicant. And you'll see the average age of people in first year, you'll still be younger than those, so don't really even bother about it. I had some people that are in the 30s, and it's fine. So I hope my experience as a successful reapplicant will help you to reapply to this faculty in the near future. And if you are accepted, when you will get to know your colleagues in the first few weeks at the class at the faculty, I hope that you will, just like added, better understand why you were not accepted the first time and know how to use that extra experience of yours to a good use. So thank you. I don't know if there are some questions or maybe on the yellow sheets or...
Merci beaucoup, Vincent. Est-ce qu'il y a des questions pour Vincent pour la perspective d'un candidat? Ou c'est plus... Non, pas pour l'instant. Why did you choose McGill over the other law schools in Montreal?
Well, it was, I'd say, when I first did my application at McGill Law, I knew the advantage of the program, and I knew I really wanted to get into McGill Law, other than just doing a civil law degree somewhere else. That was probably the main reason why I chose McGill Law, and even going to undergrad degree year before switching somewhere else.
What did you do differently in your second application that you think helped you succeed?
Well, it's probably different for every one of us, every one of you. I'm pretty sure Martin will go over it. Personally, as I said, I used the experience that I acquired in McGill. Obviously, I'm a Francophone. I never had some English education prior to doing my undergrad here. So that was one point that I stated in my second application. In the past 3 years, I've worked hard on being able to write efficiently in English, to communicate efficiently. So at one point, this is what I did differently. Maybe in terms of picking the professors or the people that you're going to ask reference letters, make sure to be smart about it. Make sure that thinking in the long term, if you find a prof that's connected to you or you like the class he teaches, then try to meet with him, try to go to his office hours. Few people do, but just try to have a close relationship with that person. It can always be useful later on. And for a reference letter, it's probably easier for him to write something that's relevant for your application more than someone general that you, yeah, she was often asking questions in class. That's all I know about it.
Merci beaucoup. Vincent, ce qu'on va peut-être faire, s'il veut rester 2 ou 3 minutes derrière, s'il y a quelqu'un qui veut lui poser une question en privé, il est disponible, mais c'est sûr que vous allez manquer le début de la prochaine section, mais il est disponible. Alors, merci beaucoup, Vincent, d'avoir pris le temps. Puis, en fait, c'est un peu courageux, je dois vous dire, parce qu'on a demandé, on a une grosse cohorte d'étudiants ambassadeurs. Et on leur a dit, on a une séance d'information pour les repostulants. Est-ce qu'il y a quelqu'un qui pourrait... Puis ça a pris... Vincent est le seul qui est venu nous voir, puis c'est sûr que ce n'est pas le seul repostulant. Alors, merci beaucoup, Vincent. OK. Alors, on va continuer. Alors, bon, le témoignage est terminé. Bon, on va continuer un petit peu sur le thème de la réalité de l'admission en droit. On est ici aujourd'hui dans la salle du tribunal école. C'est la salle qui est utilisée le premier jour de la rentrée avec la classe de première année qui est ici, donc 178 étudiants. Bon, il y a des étudiants en échange qui sont là, tous les professeurs sont là. Il y a beaucoup d'étudiants, soit dans l'association d'étudiants, etc., qui sont présents. Puis la salle est vraiment bondée. Ça, c'est la classe entrante. Si on faisait la même chose avec les candidats refusés, on pourrait remplir cette salle-ci comme 6 fois. Alors, juste pour vous donner un ordre d'idée, vous êtes quelques-uns ici aujourd'hui, mais c'est la grande majorité des candidats qui malheureusement sont refusés parce que malheureusement on n'a pas assez de place. Il y a de très bons dossiers qu'on se doit de refuser chaque année. Vous n'êtes pas seul. Moi-même, j'ai été candidate après le cégep, j'ai été refusée, puis j'ai été admise après l'université. Alors, il y a c'est vraiment très commun, puis il y a de très beaux success stories pour les repostulants. Alors, on a mis des petites photos. Vous êtes peut-être senti comme ça pendant un instant, un peu confus, un peu triste. C'est tout à fait normal. So, yes, over 1,000 reapplicants, 1,000 refused applicants every year. I was just wondering in the class, in the group, who here has is reapplying after CGEP, had been refused as a CGEP applicant? And did you just finish CGEP, or are you in the process of finishing university? Oh, CGEP, okay. Okay, okay, perfect. And other candidates were refused after university, so reapplying as university applicants? Yes. Anyone transfer advanced standing students? Not in the room. I might still mention a few things here and there just for the benefit of being thorough in my presentation, but it's a good idea to have a sense of who's here. So we compiled the stats just for fun. Last year, well, the class that started in 2013, 10% of the applicant pool was composed of reapplicants and 12% of the entering class. So the statistics are actually quite good on the being a reapplicant. There are different kinds of reapplicants. It's a big, it's a term that can mean someone like Vincent who was refused after CJEP and then reapplies 3 years later. And to your question, I think, and I will touch upon this a bit later, it's really almost two different applications because there is just so much more that will go into those extra 3 years, so many more chances of having high grades, of getting involved, that really the application of a university applicant kind of stands alone, and we don't look at the CJEP grades as much. So that's one type of reapplicant. Another type could be someone who's been refused after university, retrying again. It could be someone who was put on the wait list. Ultimately, there wasn't any space for them off of the wait list. So it's a mixed bag of candidates. And some of what I say might be more relevant to one or the other. Okay, understanding what your refusal letter was saying. So this is the part, that the start of the second part of the workshop. The first part was hopefully trying to put some context into the refusal. Now we will get into trying to understand the why of the refusal. I'm doing this. It's very fact-based. I'm going to be very transparent. It might be a little bit sensitive or a little bit painful if you think of your own case when I give you some of this information. But I'm giving it so that you know how we make decisions, what you're up against in terms of admission. So, you know, kind of take it not with a grain of salt, but try to, you know, understand you're all in the same boat. I was at some point. You're looking to the future. I'm giving you information on how we make these decisions. So as you might, as you know, it's very competitive. The numbers show it to be admitted at the faculty, and this this imbalance between the number of spots and the number of candidacies pushes us to really do a hard comparative exercise between candidacies. And as I said, we refuse a lot of candidacies that have one or more very strong elements. So this is the context of how we make decisions. So ultimately, if you were refused, it's because you might have had a very uncompetitive application. I'll talk to you about that. It's very unlikely that everything in your file was not competitive. You might have had the number of strengths, but you were refused ultimately because with the number of spots we had, there were more people with stronger applications in that year. So that's the reason. The way we make our decisions is the following. So as you know, we use a holistic approach to evaluation of the files, which means that we look at everything in your file, and I'll tell you what tangibly what these elements are, and we put it all together to try to get a global picture of who you are. And a holistic approach is meant to help a file be potentially admissible when it would be refused on one ground alone if we were using it not a holistic approach. So it's trying to kind of give us the freedom to kind of play around with the files and to give someone a break or a chance. If a lot of great elements are there, but there's really one weakness, we can kind of put all that together and try to see if that file could be admissible. The holistic approach doesn't mean that we favor candidates with weaker academic records over candidates with stronger academic records. That seems kind of obvious, but sometimes people think, oh, because we take everything into consideration, then I stand a higher chance of being admitted at McGill because of that, despite my low grades because everything else is good. Yes and no. We look at everything, yes, but academic potential is a very important part of the evaluation as well. In terms of what we use, the elements we use to make that evaluation, so we have your transcripts, all of them. We have your LSATs if you chose to write it, your CV, your personal statement, and your reference letters. In some cases, letters of extenuating circumstances with supporting documents. So that's one part of the application that may be there as well. And we look for evidence of linguistic abilities throughout all of these documents. So we look at all of that together. And then we want to make sure there is potential for academic success. We won't admit anyone who would come here and fail. If, you know, we can predict that as best we can, we won't make that poison gift to anyone. So we look for potential for academic success and linguistic abilities. These are kind of minimums. And then we will assess your potential for future contribution, so who you are on top of everything that the grades can tell us. We don't have any weights. We don't have any cutoffs about, you know, is the CV more important than the personal statement? It's not 10%, 10%, 50% for the grades, and then 10% for each reference letter. It's not the way it works. It's more fluid than that, and but we do it. I mean, I don't want to get too much into the admissions, general admissions information session on what we look for in our policy. I know you know all of that. But these are the elements we look at. And for having read thousands and thousands of files, and the way the committee reads them, you can have one of these elements. So transcripts, LSAT, CV, personal statement, reference letter. You can have one of them that's average or weaker. You can have two maybe if the rest are really good. But if you have two or more that are average, or a bit, you know, compared to the pool, below average, it's not going to work. It's not going to be. So through this workshop, we hope you can find where your weaknesses are and address them. So the way decisions are made, your file is read holistically by one or more committee members. So it's not that one person reviews one part and another person reviews another part. Obviously, that wouldn't work. We need one brain at a time to make a holistic evaluation and make a recommendation on your file. And then I guess there are two levels of comparisons. What that committee member has as a reference point of what all the other files they've read up to date is and what the level are and how unique your file is compared to that and how strong it is compared to the other ones they've read. So that's one first level of comparison that is being done in deciding how to recommend. And then there is an ultimate comparison done by the person who reads all of the files on behalf of the committee, which is me. So this, and kind of each time it, your odds are kind of getting slimmer in the sense that you're up against a bigger part of the pool and ultimately all of the pool for that year. Okay. Your letter of refusal, if you still have it, it's electronic it's been electronic for a while, so you probably still have it. If you want to go back and look, the committee actually has the ability to circle different options for the letters you'll be getting. The letter you'll be getting will have, it's called a postscript, so it's like a sentence or two that we insert, and that will depend on the reasons why you were refused. So by going back and looking at that, you can actually have a sense of where your weaknesses were, or some of your strengths might be highlighted as well. So the first postscript that we use, and this is the most commonly used, it's the one that says that there are many positive elements to your file, but overall it was not competitive. So this is, I know because I'm the one doing the circling, this means probably that there was not one glaring weakness in your file. If there were, it would be one of the other postscripts that we'll talk about. So it means there was a mix. I mean, hypothetically, it could be the case that everything was, all of these five elements were borderline or below. It's very rare that someone is not competitive at any level. So this letter is saying to you there was a mix. You had some weaknesses, you had some strengths. But the weaknesses were not all catastrophic. So if you can kind of think of your own file and go through the list, and you can probably try to narrow it down. And I'll keep feeding you information to do that throughout this workshop. So your file might have had competitive elements on their own, but together it didn't come overall as a strong enough academic file. If someone has a really good academic record, an LSAT, it can happen that they are refused. It's because the rest of the file was really not competitive, the personal statement, the reference letters, and the CV. So, and this is the option we would choose in that case. So that could be one situation also. A second postscript that we can have is it mentions that the academic portion is not competitive. So as opposed to positive elements, you know, and overall not competitive, this is singling out the academic performance part. And this one is probably the most heartbreaking one, because the grades, in my mind, when we put that as a postscript, it's because the academic performance is not just borderline, it's several percentage points met below the admitted average or even the range. So this is kind of out of the ballpark type of refusal on academic grounds. And it's heartbreaking because that's something that's hard to change. So unless you have a new superb LSAT, you do a master's, you do superbly, sometimes people do another undergrad and do really well. Unless there was information we didn't have about why that performance was what it was, chances of being readmitted are lower than in the other postscripts that you have. So that's a hard one. Insufficient French proficiency. As you know, we have a requirement of passive bilingualism. There could be a postscript for insufficient English proficiency, but in fact, it never really happens. So that means that your file, it's not that we assess the French and it could be borderline. No, if we circle that, it's because the evidence of French is zero or, you know, really basic elementary French. And it could mean that the rest of your file was really good as well. So if you have that, that's good. You can work on that as a postscript. Another postscript could be that your undergraduate degree will not be finished by the time you would register in law school. So you know we require at least 60 credits to apply. But in fact, and we disclose this all over at all our information sessions and on our website, the pool being what it is, and a lot of people are applying with what is going to be a completed undergraduate degree or a master's or more. So someone who would come to us with some studies but no diploma, no university degree, is not going to be competitive. I don't remember the time that we would have had admitted someone with only 60 credits of university. So as a matter of fact, when we see a file like that, we'll go through it unless it's absolutely stellar and on every count, in which case we'll hesitate about it for a while. But in every other case, we will just tell you, you won't have your degree, so reapply later. So this is positive too. Refuse post-interview, we have that option of circling that. It's very rare we use it because CJEP candidates who are refused wouldn't necessarily have that. We encourage all CJEP applicants who have gone through an interview to just reapply after their undergraduate degree. So this is something that we could use for mature applicants, in some cases university applicants whom we've met in interview. So it's just more as a personalization of the letter. You can infer from that the performance at the interview was an important element of the decision. lastly, some a last postscript that can be used is that we would encourage you to reapply. So it means to us there are many good elements in your file. I mean, this, you know, can be combined with, if you have the insufficient French proficiency, obviously you're encouraged to reapply if you fix that. If you haven't finished your degree, you're encouraged to reapply when you do finish it. So, but that could be just someone who has a lot of positive elements and was just too borderline to make it to the wait list. Or it could be that there are many great things, but there's something, one thing that needs to be fixed. So it could be you had a low LSAT, maybe you should rewrite it. It could be the French as well. We might have circled insufficient French if really the French was the one glaring problem. So I hope this is helpful if you go back to your letter to know why we chose to put that into your letter. Okay. Saisir vos forces et vos faiblesses. Alors, on continue dans l'exercice d'auto-évaluation, puis de regarder un peu vers le passé pour voir comment était notre première demande. Try to, if you can, look at yourself as objectively as you can. So we're going to try to situate you with regard to the rest of the group. So academic competitiveness. As I said when I was talking about the various refusal letter messages that we give you, it's competitive to be admitted, and academics is something that the professors, the faculty really cares about. We want to admit students who will not fail. There's a very high retention rate, and students who will do more than not fail, who will do well. I mean, we don't expect everyone to be an A student, because we admit almost A students with, you know, I'll give you the range, but, and they turn out to be some A students, a lot of B students, and some C students. So, we know how demanding it is, the volume of readings. It's just like this. You have to be very, very smart and very academically smart to succeed here. So this is something we will look at. And what's difficult about, you know, assessing your strengths or weaknesses is that the academic picture is something that has happened and kind of sticks with you. So your record, your undergraduate record, is what it is. You write the LSAT. It's there. We'll always find it. So there are things you can do to improve it, and we'll go into that. But that's kind of the hard part of my message as well, is the academic performance. So just to give you the range, so the entering averages of the class, for university candidates overall, the academic performance is an average of 84, or a GPA of 3.7 on a 4.0 scale. For those who wrote the LSAT, that's the average LSAT for the class. And for those who came from CJEP, this is the average performance from CJEP. I can nuance that a little bit and tell you that the range in the last few years, we've admitted someone, I think, last year down to 75%, and all the way up to, I think, 94%. For the LSAT, we've gone into the low 150s. For the R-score, I think last year we admitted someone with an R-score of 30.5 or 30.7. So there is a range, and even when you look at it, these are all super good grades. And I always have to kind of recalibrate myself, because the pool is really competitive. There are very few applicants who have dismal grades, really. There aren't any. And so someone who has a 72, that's a B, you know, B plus average. It's in university, so it's really good. And it probably means someone would come here and would be able to function in the classes and keep up with the readings and do fine. But there are some who apply who have really, really good grades, and the rest is good too. Please, if you can write your question, we'll get to it. So, and I know this always elicits a lot of reaction. But as I said, if you are a CJEP, if you were a CJEP applicant, and you know, academic performance being what it is, if you go through university, your CJEP grades will almost, we'll look at them, but it's not going to be a decision, a tiebreaker, or anything. So, so if you've had these types of grades, or more, or better, there are some, but and you were still refused. When we look at the stats, I know how many people are admitted or refused within each bracket of grades. It probably means that the rest, probably the CV might have been lower. I presume the reference letters would have been really good as well. Or the personal statement, sometimes candidates have really good grades and they kind of don't put as much of an effort in the rest of the application, kind of thinking their grades are going to carry them through. So it might be these two things that you need to work on. But definitely the grades are not hindering you. If ever you have these types of grades and you have been refused, one thing just to be mindful of is the fact that we will look at the level of difficulty of the courses you've taken. If you've taken, like, for each term, every year, you've taken what we know are easy courses, one or two a term, it's going to start leaving an impression of you're taking the easy way. And even though you might have had good grades, it might have made a nuanced impression on the committee. We will look at the progression of your curriculum if you haven't taken anything over a 300-level course or just maybe one 400-level course when others have, you know, challenged themselves with higher-level courses. All of these things would have been taken into account. So I know it's not fun stuff to be telling you, but I'm just trying to help you work through your own file to see where you might have had a weakness and where you might have some strengths that you can continue to leverage. Profil concurrentiel au-delà du dossier scolaire. Alors, ça, c'est tout le reste. Qu'est-ce qu'on recherche quand on regarde tout le reste? Qu'est-ce qui peut avoir été plus ou moins fort dans votre dossier? Donc, le CV, ce qui peut peut-être vous avoir désavantagé, des fois dans le CV, il y a beaucoup d'appartenance à des clubs étudiants, mais pas vraiment de rôle de leadership. Des fois, on peut remarquer que c'est un CV plus passif qu'actif, par exemple. Quoi d'autre? Pour le CV, vraiment, il y a plein de combinaisons qui peuvent être très impressionnantes. Les études et le travail et le sport, le bénévolat et le sport, la musique et le bénévolat. En tout cas, tout ça peut fonctionner. Donc, si vous faites ce que vous faites, vous êtes passionné, que vous vous impliquez, ça peut être de vous impliquer dans une ou deux choses plus en profondeur plutôt que de vous inscrire au début d'une session à plein de clubs qui, finalement, vous permettent pas de démontrer votre potentiel de leadership. Donc, ça, c'est des choses qu'on peut avoir remarquées dans votre dossier. Quelque chose qui peut être moins compétitif comparativement au reste, aux très bonnes candidatures du bassin, c'est quelqu'un qui avait des emplois d'été, mais rien d'autre nécessairement pendant l'année, et pour qui les notes sont bonnes, mais pas vraiment excellentes. Donc, ça, on peut s'être dit, comparativement à d'autres, ils auraient eu le temps d'avoir des meilleures notes d'après le CV. Ils n'ont pas vraiment eu ces meilleures notes-là. Donc, ça, c'est un exercice qui peut avoir été fait par le comité aussi. La lettre de présentation personnelle ou personal statement. Ça, en termes de, spécifiquement pour les repostulants, des fois, ce qui peut avoir manqué, ou ce que je dis souvent qui peut avoir manqué, des fois, la question, avez-vous répondu aux grandes questions qu'on vous indique? Là, pourquoi vous voulez étudier le droit? Pourquoi à McGill? Et qu'est-ce que vous apporteriez? Puis des fois, là, pourquoi le droit? Des fois, les gens passent tout droit ou ils effleurent le sujet. Ils pensent que peut-être quand juste le fait de faire une demande, ça devrait démontrer qu'ils sont intéressés. Oui, mais c'est un exercice de réflexion aussi pour nous. Alors, votre motivation est peut-être là, elle est peut-être très bien justifiée dans votre tête, mais c'est un exercice de le mettre sur papier et de nous convaincre. Des fois, c'est quelque chose qui peut avoir manqué. Les lettres de recommandation, elles sont pratiquement toujours très positives. Donc, c'est rarement un élément négatif dans un dossier. Là, encore une fois, avec mes lunettes noires, là, quand j'essaie de voir les problèmes, si vous avez une lettre qui avait un élément négatif, quelqu'un soit qui ne recommande pas l'admission ou qui apporte beaucoup de caveat à sa recommandation, c'est très rare, mais si c'est le cas, oui, vous avez un problème. Ben, vous avez un problème sur les bras dans le sens que ça va porter préjudice à votre demande. Ça arrive très rarement. Mais ça peut être le cas. Quelque chose d'autre dans les lettres de recommandation qui peut des fois faire qu'elles sont moins impressionnantes, si elles ont l'air d'être vraiment copiées-collées, ou si, comme Vincent parlait, qu'elles font référence juste, elle a participé en classe, ou des fois on le voit, là, c'est tellement peu détaillé qu'on voit que la personne ne vous connaît pas tant que ça. Donc, c'est pas négatif, mais ça vous a pas aidé autant que ça aurait pu. Quelque chose d'autre qu'on voit des fois dans les lettres de recommandation, si elles sont de professeurs, on s'attend à ce que le professeur parle de votre potentiel académique. Si le professeur ne parle que de vos qualités personnelles, que vous êtes, que vous venez toujours à l'heure en classe, que vous rendez vos travaux à l'heure, c'est très important. Mais ça, c'est presque comme si on le présumait. Puis s'il ne parle pas du volet académique, de vos réflexes, votre façon de penser, la qualité des interventions que vous avez faites, la qualité de la recherche dans vos travaux, il y a peut-être un petit quelque chose qui manque pour les lettres académiques. Bon, les aptitudes linguistiques, ça, c'est vraiment est-ce qu'elles sont là, est-ce qu'elles ne sont pas là. Donc, ce n'est pas une question est-ce qu'il est parfaitement bilingue ou... C'est pas ça qui va être plus fort que quelqu'un qui est passivement bilingue. Mais c'est ça, on va le rechercher dans le dossier. Et puis, bon, c'est quelque chose qui peut être amélioré si ça manque. Ensuite, ça, je l'ai mis ici. Circonstances atténuantes, ça va plutôt avec le volet académique. C'est un document qu'on va lire... pour mettre un contexte à votre performance académique. Des fois, ça peut avoir eu un effet sur le CV également. Ce n'est pas tout le monde qui en met. C'est une décision personnelle de choisir d'en mettre ou non. Est-ce que les circonstances atténuantes, celles qui sont supportées par une preuve extérieure ou quand c'est quelque chose qui pourrait exister, ça peut avoir plus solidifié l'empathie que le comité va donner à votre dossier. Des fois, si c'est seulement, ça c'est des scénarios rares, là, mais comme une longue liste d'excuses de tout ce qui a pu arriver à cette personne-là dans la vie, mais c'est comme il n'y a rien de tangible vraiment non plus. Le comité va lire, puis moi je trouve que le comité est très, très généreux de donner le bénéfice du doute, puis donner moins de poids quand il y en a. Mais des fois, ça atteint un moment où on trouve que ça manque un petit peu de crédibilité, des fois. Mais ça, je parle des scénarios extrêmes. Là. Quand on parle de ce qui peut aller mal, là, si je fais la liste, puis après ça, on va passer à d'autres choses. OK. So now we will move to the last part of the workshop, which is looking forward. So you are thinking of reapplying for this year or another year. I'm going to talk about what mistakes I've seen in the reapplication, not in the application that got refused, in the reapplication. The two most common one we see and that usually leads to an unsuccessful reapplication is that the candidate really doesn't change all that much. And I should maybe nuance that by saying, if you were put on the wait list until the last minute, ultimately refused at the beginning of September, and you reapply 1 month or 2 months later, there's not that much that could have changed, and obviously there was something really, really good about your candidacy. So that's kind of an exception to the rule. Those could get away with not changing that much. But otherwise, if you've been refused, there might be things to improve over there, even though, you know, there might be a lot of positive points. So that's something we see. It's like people sometimes think, oh, well, maybe I'll just kind of wait for the pool to become less competitive or wait for my luck to turn. If I do my recruitment job well, that's not going to happen. The pool is going to remain very competitive, and I'm working really hard for that to happen. So if you've been refused or more than once, you should think that, well, you should maybe think of applying to other law schools as well, and I'm going to talk about that later on. But you might need to rethink your personal statement. You might want to think of writing the LSAT, etc. So that's a common pitfall. The second one is a bit more subtle, but I've seen it a lot, where a candidacy is refused, and they reapply, but what was good about that file is now great, but what was weaker about that file is just still just as weak. And it's and it took me time to realize that the committee will not get past a major weakness. You know, well, there's the holistic approach that gives us a bit of flexibility, but if there's something really, really weak, and I read here academic performance, it's usually the case, you can add something else that's great on your CV and, you know, another great experience, another great internship, but until that is addressed or redressed, it's still going to be holding you down from being admitted. So these are variations, but the second one is just, I think, a very natural tendency to do what you're good at, but you might want to try to work on the weakness, even though it's more painful to do so for you. Okay. Des autres, d'autres pièges courants, mais ça revient un peu. Il y a beaucoup de thèmes qui reviennent. De ne pas avoir amélioré les aptitudes linguistiques qui sont requises, c'est quelque chose qu'on voit des fois. Ça aussi, ça revient au fait que ce n'est pas nécessairement facile. C'est faisable, mais ce n'est pas facile d'apprendre une deuxième langue ou d'amener notre compréhension à un autre niveau. Donc, des gens vont peut-être essayer de compenser d'une autre façon, mais ça, c'est vraiment un minimum. Le bilinguisme passif, il faut l'avoir. Donc, peu importe si vous êtes amélioré, si ça n'a pas changé, votre demande risque d'être encore refusée. Bon, donc en un mot, manque d'adaptabilité, c'est la nature humaine se révèle là, dans des processus comme ceux-là, puis il y a des gens qui vont prendre un refus, qui vont venir à une séance comme aujourd'hui, qui vont essayer de comprendre, qui vont réajuster leur tir, ils vont faire des demandes à d'autres facultés de droit, ils vont aller faire un premier bac s'ils venaient du cégep. Puis il y en a d'autres qui se planquent dans leur position, là, qui trouvent qu'ils sont bons, puis c'est comme ça, puis ça ne change pas. Puis le passé est le garant de l'avenir dans ce sens-là, qu'il faut faire preuve de flexibilité. Comme nous, on trouve que ça serait normal si vous avez fait une demande une fois, bon, une fois après le cégep, puis faire comme Vincent, de dire, moi, c'est vraiment à McGill, j'ai fait la même chose, on peut comprendre. Mais si vous, d'une année à l'autre, vous refaites une demande, puis vous n'êtes pas admis à McGill, nous, on trouve que ce serait normal que vous fassiez des demandes dans d'autres facultés de droit, parce que ça prouve que c'est ce que vous voulez faire, étudier le droit. Ça prouve que vous êtes capable de vous adapter à la situation, puis si vous le faites, ben au moins, ça ne sera pas ça de perdu. Là, vous allez pouvoir commencer à amorcer vos études dans une autre faculté puis commencer à atteindre votre rêve d'étudiant en droit. Donc, ça, c'est des pièges. Quelque chose d'autre? Un autre piège, puis je vais peut-être en parler un peu plus loin dans les documents justificatifs, c'est le fait que le nouvel essai personnel ne fait que parler du refus et du chemin parcouru depuis le refus. Et oublie de parler de pourquoi on veut aller en droit, pourquoi on veut le faire à McGill, etc. Donc, ça, je vais en parler plus loin. Votre nouvelle demande doit se tenir toute seule. Ça se peut que le comité, c'est très probable que le comité va aller voir le dossier d'avance, si on l'a encore. Ça, je vais vous expliquer dans quel temps on ne l'a pas. Mais vous ne pouvez pas présumer ça. Puis, ça peut être mauvais comme bon, là, qu'aille voir le passé. Mais votre demande actuelle doit se tenir toute seule. Un dernier piège que je vais mentionner, puis ça, c'est on est plus dans l'exercice de jugement. Quelque chose qu'il ne faut pas faire, puis c'est rare, là, mais c'est dans la façon dont vous gérez votre refus, votre premier refus, c'est de brûler des ponts avec la faculté de droit. Des fois, la façon dont les gens se comportent en réaction à leur refus, la façon dont ils vont parler à Lindy ou à moi, des fois, ça peut un peu nous laisser une impression négative de cette personne-là. Puis, il n'y a vraiment aucune raison qu'une personne refusée qui est intéressée à refaire une demande laisse une mauvaise impression. Mais c'est important de garder tous les ponts ouverts avec la faculté de droit. On comprend que c'est la nature peut-être des étudiants en droit ou ce que vous pensez qui est le stéréotype de l'avocat, d'aimer argumenter, puis de combattre les injustices, puis ils voient leur propre refus comme un exemple de ça, là, qu'il faut qu'ils... C'est vrai, mais un bon juriste va le faire avec intégrité, avec intelligence, avec respect, puis avec une bonne écoute aussi de ce que l'autre partie ou de l'autre côté va dire. Donc, si dans votre comportement, vous faites justement preuve d'une absence de ces éléments-là, on va voir ça comme un manque de maturité, un manque de jugement. Puis ce sont des éléments qu'on recherche dans nos candidats. Donc, ça s'applique, en tout cas, j'ai pas l'impression que ça s'applique à vous, mais ça arrive chaque année, là, il y en a vraiment qui se rendent pas service, hein, dans la façon dont ils font affaire avec la faculté. OK. So, a few more points of information for you. So, obviously, in the useful tips, avoid the common pitfalls. So everything I've said, be open, be lucid, be adaptable, also referring to the other, to the common pitfalls. Okay, more tips. So this is the crux of the matter in a lot of cases of reapplication. Can I redress my lack of academic competitiveness? And I should have put that in quotation mark, because lack of academic competitiveness, you know, from our perspective, is it a lot below 84% or an R score of 34, which are outstanding results. So it's not that there's a lack of academic competitiveness. It's compared, well, you might have performed very well academically, but it might still be something that to be very competitive at that level at the faculty is something you need to work on. So what can be done if this is something, when you look at the numbers, you think it's something you need to work on? What can be done? We would recommend, if you're comfortable in English, considering writing the LSAT. Rewriting the LSAT, perhaps, but certainly thinking of writing it if you haven't done it, because it gives us a fresh element that can help us, that help bring your file up on the academic front. Some people choose to do a master's or redo an undergrad, which is a whole undertaking, but sometimes some people do that. I wouldn't do all these things just for the purpose of making your file to apply to law school more competitive. Obviously, you need to want to acquire that life experience, as Vincent was talking about. If you are a CJEP applicant, you can reapply with 1 year at the university. With experience, I know that you're not going to get so many great grades in university. If academic performance is something you need to look at, you might be better off just doing an undergrad than reapplying after 1 year, because the weight of all the CEGEP grades with a few university grades, it might not help your file up enough coming from that background. Something else, if your grades were good, and they were good enough to be admitted to another law school in Canada, one thing you can do is think of accepting that offer and going somewhere and maybe falling in love with the place, and then you'll be on your way to completing your legal studies. And if you still think of McGill, you can apply as a transfer student. And this is quite, not a lot of people do that. We don't have a lot of applications. The ratio to the number of spots the offers we make to the people who apply is just as good or just as competitive, if not slightly better. It depends on the year. But so there's really, it's not like your dog is dead or your ton chien est mort, if you're refused and you go to law school to another law school. Because the grades you would get in law school, and all schools in Canada are competitive and very good. So, and if you do well, that's going to be very probant in reapplying as a transfer student. So that's really something to think of doing. Another tip, okay, check our admission instructions every year. As a reapplicant, you might remember the way it was done the year you applied, but things might change. For example, this year, there are changes to the CV and the reference letters. I'll talk about that briefly. And for example, 1 year we decided to include the fact that if your academic performance is below the admitted average, you could think of writing the LSAT. So if you had applied a few years before that, that tip might not have had that tip from us. So these are things you really should look every year, because it might change. And actually, we started getting some applications from reapplicants with documents, and sometimes the documents don't conform to the new instructions. So it's kind of too bad. So what goes in a new application? First of all, I think you might know, if you've applied in the last 3 years, we still have your file. If it's longer than 3 years, it's been shredded. So for better or for worse, it's all lost, and you need everything anew. If you are reapplying within 3 years, we'll have your old file. And what that means is that the committee will have both the new and the old, and it's kind of at the discretion of each member to decide how much of the old one they would read. With experience, I know that they for sure will read the decision that had been made. They might look at the personal statement and the CV, but you can't presume that. So in a new application, so even if we have an old one, you still need to resubmit online the whole application, pay your $100, and there are some documents that you must submit. And you know that because you've been on the website, but you need to submit a new CV. And this year, all CVs must fit on 2 pages, which is a change from last year. So for sure, your CV will look, well, for sure, it might very well look different this year. So that you must submit a new personal statement. And as I said earlier, the personal statement has to kind of stand on its own feet, answer the questions we have, and you can find some place in there to speak of your experience since the last application if you choose to do so. And you can't presume the committee will reread the old one, because, I mean, it's a lot of documents. Transcripts and reference letters, it depends. If you've had any grade since your first application, or maybe in your first application the transcript was had all your courses, but it didn't have your graduation, for instance, you would have to resubmit a new transcript, or obviously of anything subsequent as well, a master's or anything else. For the reference letters, we will have your old ones. If it's less than 3 years, you can choose to keep those. You can choose to put 2 new ones. That's for you to decide. This year, what's new as well is that we take two and no more than two letters. So you have to make that call. Well, every candidate has to decide who the two respondents will be. Oh, one thing to think about also, were your reference letters both academic? It depends on the profile of the person. Someone who's been out of school for a long time might very well submit a professional reference letter, which is great. But someone who's kind of mainstream in university or just out of university, we would recommend academic reference letters. So that's something to think about. The new application must stand on its own merits. And let me make sure. I think I covered everything. Okay. So for the Q&A, I have some here. Are there any, can Lindsay collect any other questions of general interest? That would be more useful. I can start. I got a number of those from earlier in the session, and some of them are, if I have time, I'll answer all, but if not, I'll focus on the ones that really speak to the reapplicant issue as opposed to more general admissions questions. Okay. So there's one here. A reapplicant from CGEP who does not attend university this year is required to have their application in by what date? So unless that person will remain a CGEP applicant. Unless you go to university, you're not a university applicant. Unless you've been out of school for 5 years, you're not a mature applicant. So you would remain a CGEP applicant, so your deadline would be March 1st. Does the personal statement previously written get read a second time with a new application? You can't rely on it. It might very well be, but you need the second statement to be full and convincing. So these are some of. If a mature applicant is refused admission, what kind of things can he or she do to increase the chances of acceptance the next time? So here the nuance is someone who's out of school, the mature applicant. I think all of this, all that I said would apply. It might be more of an effort to choose to go back to do, if the academic performance is an element that might need to work, might be more of an effort, but still we would need some kind of reassurance on the academic front. So it could be an LSAT or a master's, or if someone's out of CGEP, it could be undertaking university studies. So, and in terms of the rest of the application, I think that's more general information on the personal statement. Some of it for all reapplicants, and the rest is something that general information sessions on admission might cover, you know, what to put in a personal statement and the CV, and et cetera. Let me know, Lindsay, if you see some specifically for reapplicants. This is more general, but I think we have time. How does graduate work factor into the calculation of GPA or academic merit? So to have a level playing field in terms of the evaluation of the academic record is done in two ways. So there is a calculation way, because we need to make statistics on these things. So we need to come up with each file with a GPA. So that will be done on the basis of the undergrad alone, because everyone has one in that category except for the CGEP applicants. So in that sense, the master's grades won't be taken into account into that calculation. That's the calculation done for the purposes of keeping stats and kind of helping us triage the files, etc. But the committee members will go through the transcript line by line and look at all the courses taken and the class averages for all the courses. And this is where the evaluation of the performance at the master's level will come into place. So it's just as it's given due consideration. It's given a little bit less weight than the undergrad because not everyone has one. And the grades at a master's level tend to be higher too. I think there is, I know at McGill and law, I think there's nothing below a B or a B minus. So everyone's kind of in the B, B plus, A minus range. So it can help you up for sure if you have like all straight A's and A minuses and one B plus and you've been doing well and you get a really good reference letter from a thesis supervisor that's really, that can really help. Okay, what is the most understated part of the application that factors into admission decisions? Understated part. It's hard to say. Right. I mean, I guess the soft stuff, if anything, it would. We really go, and you could see the grid of comments. It's really academic performance and LSAT, CV, personal statement, reference letters. So we really look at all of these in a lot of detail. I mean, it's more the absence of that might strike us, like absence of judgment in some of the way, in the way you decide to put your application together or in what the referees will say, or absence of maturity. But we're talking like at a kind of a worrisome level. These are things that, I mean, it's part of our admissions policy, actually. But if things transpire through the application that make us think this person, you know, would not be best suited for the faculty, it might factor into the decision. But these are kind of, so I don't really know what more to say about that question. What do you look for in reference letters? I think I said where it can go, you know, where it's maybe a little bit less impressive. The reference letters that are the most helpful are the ones from professors, ideally, but for mature candidates, professional references can be really, really strong as well. Who know you, who can speak to the way you think about a problem, how you've done research, how you've been original in your thought process, and if they can confirm that you're reliable and you submit things on time, and I think that's what an outstanding letter is. Often, and we in the instructions to the referees, a document that you have obviously that you would give to your referee, if they can give information about how you performed in comparison to the rest of your group, your class, that's helpful as well. Are we allowed to sit in on classes that are happening through the semester? So that's a question we get sometimes. McGill doesn't allow people to audit or like sit in. No, that's not allowed. So there are different ways to go about it. Someone who wants to take maritime law because they work for a maritime company and their boss thinks that would be great and they would want to learn more about it, but they have no interest in becoming a jurist. That's one category of applicant. It's called a special applicant, and they submit an application with all of these documents, and then we give them the right to register in that class, and they go and they take the exam and they have a transcript. So that's one way to go about it, to kind of go sit in on a class. Coming from this audience, I'm presuming it's someone who's interested in going to law school but would want to know what they can, you know, if it's really for them and what it looks like. So when resources allow, and it's not always the case, we can pair you up with the student ambassador who can take you to one of her classes with her. So that can be arranged through our office. It depends, you know, if it's exam period or it's not going to work. It depends if we have people available. We can try to match your interest if we can with the student ambassador in their list of classes. It can be done. It's if you're doing it, you know, out of a genuine interest for the subject matter, you can. If you're doing it as a kind of a PR, a PR move on your part to get to know some law students, maybe drop in and see the prof at the end of the class, that's not going to, we don't want that to become a way people make themselves known to the faculty, because then we would need to give that possibility to everyone else who's applying, and we don't have the resources to do that. So it can exist, but in a kind of a controlled environment. Okay. So a few questions here about personal statement. Do you have some on the reapplicants, maybe that would be? Okay, so I'll talk about the French proficiency and then we can talk about the personal statement. So the French proficiency, we don't make it a requirement that anyone take a standardized language as a French as a second language test. I think that would be prohibitive in terms of cost, and the pool the way it is, usually candidates will have in their application different elements that can point us to that proficiency in both languages. So we will look. If someone went to CJEP, so we will be able to look at their performance in those other language classes. If you're coming from CJEP in Quebec, it's usually not an issue. We can look at university courses. A lot of people will take, some will have a minor in French. Others will take language classes throughout. Some will do a summer intensive course and we'll have a transcript for that. Some have gone on exchange somewhere where they speak French. And we can see that some of the courses were offered in French. So we will start to have a sense of different elements. And there is in the application a part where you say how you learned French and English. So that's our starting point, is looking at that. If it's no, don't speak French, then we will look through the file to make sure it's not that the person didn't understand the question, kind of giving the benefit of the doubt here. But, and then if there is no evidence, the file is not going to go any further at this point. But so there are sometimes, you know, someone who's done French immersion for a certain number of years from grade school or just high school or different variations of that. So we know there's a basis. Not necessarily anything really recent. So these are cases where we might have to push the investigation a little further, and we might do that by phone calls, spot checking, possibly an online language proficiency test that is designed specifically for assessing passive bilingualism in a legal context. So that's the way we do it. And I have to say, we want to be as rigorous as we can at the admissions level, because I've seen students who might have been good enough for passive bilingualism by our standard, but and they have the ability, but it's so much more work for them to take a law course in their other language that they're kind of overwhelmed by that. And that's what we've tried to avoid, but for sure, taking a course in your other language is going to be more work. And some people choose to do that, and some people don't have the choice, because if the sections are full, we just put people wherever. And, you know, we try to respect choices as much as we can, but it comes a point in the year where we just have to fill the classes, and so it's for real, the proficiency in both languages. You could very well need it in a very real way, like 2 weeks into school. You're in the French section. So about the personal statement, all people ask always, what to do with a personal statement? So we have instructions, I think, that you can read and reread on our website on what to, you know, what we're looking for, the three big questions, what's more helpful, less helpful. So you can go and read it. We actually revisited this with the admissions committee last year. We were like, okay, do we change it up? Do we do something a little bit different? Are we more directive into what we want? And the committee said, no. We like the open-endedness of the personal statement to give you a chance to really say what you want to say and convince us or not convince us. So it's hard for me to say, well, obviously, if it goes over the page limit, it's going to look like you can't follow instructions. So that's obvious. Some people give anecdotes. Some people, kind of speak more of their path to law. Some people pick a topic of law and kind of work their motivation around that. It can take any form, really. It has to be, you have to make an effort to have it be really well edited, and no typos and things like that. You want to make sure you answer the three questions, but how you go about doing that, it's really up to you. From a reapplicant's perspective, I think what has not necessarily worked is the word-for-word, the same personal statement. But those are rare. Those are the non-adaptable applicants, and they're rare. Others, at the other extreme, only focus on the last 4 months of their lives and kind of forget to talk about the basic why law, everything else. The really good ones have some depth to them. You don't get the sense that they only scratch the surface or repeat what we want to hear or what we say about our program. You can see it's a real reflection and in someone who's able to push their own analysis a little further. So, some might say, oh, I want to go to law school because that's what I've been wanting to do since I was a child. And, I loved arguing at the dinner table with my family. But it doesn't go further. Okay, why have you always wanted to study law? There are different levels of analysis, and we would look the ones that are most convincing, take that reflection to another level. Sometimes it's very short, the personal statement, and it makes some of my colleagues really worried when they see a one-page personal statement because there's a window to express a lot. If you've done so convincingly in one page, that's great, but it might not have been so convincing. So don't be afraid to really take the full 2 pages. If you're going to be redundant, not necessarily, but it's 2 pages because we expect you to say quite a bit. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, good question. It's not necessarily a reapplicant question. Although reapplicants are on top of their game, and that's why we're having this as the first session. So does applying early and submitting all the documents early mean that your file gets assessed earlier and that you would get a response earlier, but still after November 1st? That's a really good question, and it's quite complex in answering it. We encourage people to apply early. It makes our job easier. And yes, if your file is ready early and the committee is all set and we have a little pile ready to go, we will circulate it to committee. So you could get reviewed quite early on. Does it mean that ultimately you'll get a decision early? Not necessarily, unfortunately, because the application window is only 2 months. And it's good and it's bad. It's good because we kind of get the applications complete within probably a month because even the super keeners might not have everything ready before October 1st, let's say. So at the end of the day, the date it became complete is not, it's not like a rolling process in that sense. We kind of have all of our university, well, all but the CJEP applicants together more or less ready at the same time, and then we will circulate them according to other criteria than the date at which they were arrived. So if it's really early, maybe you could. If it's in October, then you're just in the bulk of it. And the way we circulate the files, from our perspective, we try to make, our goal is to make offers to the strongest candidates early because they will be getting offers from other places and we want to have a higher chance of having them accept our offers. So that being our underlying priority, we triage the files that that according to the first approach, which is academic performance, if they looked like they would be really, really strong, we would circulate them first, along with the ones that got completed early, and then kind of move from there. But what happens is at the end of the process, everything kind of comes back to be evaluated, as I said, in that kind of comparative to the entire pool, and that can take some time. So it might have been read early by one member, two members, and then it might be stuck in the middle of the pack in terms of getting an answer. But this year, well, we've been getting faster and faster. We've made a lot of decisions before Christmas. Usually these are the favorable ones, as I said, the ones we really need to be fast on, and we've been quite steady at putting out the refusals as well. So the answer is not automatically. If you apply early, you're not going to get an answer early automatically. Were the other questions interesting? How do you decide if an applicant needs to be interviewed in the matcher category? That's a good question. That's left at the discretion of the committee. Committee members might want to... We try to minimize the number of interviews, to be honest, because it's very resource-intensive, and it gives another opportunity, for better or for worse, for someone to stand out. So we try to be as paper-based as possible. The cases where we might, it's someone who has a very interesting profile, and it could be in other categories as well, but there's something that the committee needs to be reassured on. So it might be questions they actually want to sit and ask that person. It might be testing academic reflexes that might have been out of use for a long time. Things that as a non-academic you don't necessarily think about every day unless you're very gifted for academic work. So these are things that might want to be checked by the committee, but it's at the discretion of the committee. Okay, does multiple LSAT scores count against you? Well, if they're all much below the admitted average or the range, as I said, the range starts like in the low 150s and it can go up to 180. So if someone has 4 or 5 LSATs in the high 140s, yes, it will start to count against you. But one could count against you too if it's very low. We don't have repeated high LSAT scores. Obviously, someone who's happy with their score is just not going to take that test again and put themselves through that again. So I wouldn't say the multiple factor is necessarily what goes against you. It's more the score. But if we see a progression, we could say, okay, so we see the person might not have been super well prepared for the first one, and then they kind of got their act together and got a bit better, and so that can be positive in taking it multiple times. It's not a bad test in the sense that I guess it measures what it measures, and it does so relatively consistently. So it's quite rare to see a big gap between different scores, unless something didn't work as it should have in the first testing. What time is it, Lindsay? 6:03. So we might be just about ready. Is there another? Yes, I can take one more. Okay. If you received a refusal in May, does that mean that you survived several rounds of refusals? May is the last stretch. Like, we tried to have all the decisions out by the end of May. So it can mean two things. Practically speaking, it can mean the committee hesitated because there were a lot of positive elements, and we were wanting to see what the pool was like to see if that file could be borderline admissible. So that could be one. That's most likely what it is. It could be also that it was read by the number of readers assigned, so one or two, and then it was presumed, it was recommended refuse, and then it just stalled until we got around to it, which is another reality as well. So it could be one of the two, but we're quite fast at, you know, making the easy refusals. These, you know, there aren't that many of them, but we're quite fast. So you could be refused in January, and that was an easy refuse, but you could be refused later on, and it was an easy refuse. Or it could be a really nuanced one that it gave us a headache, and there are a lot of those in May. On the admits and on the refuse files, like, it's just files that have a lot of good elements. There's something that's slowing us down from making an offer, and we just want to see everything before we make a decision. So thank you so much for coming. We would be grateful to get your green sheet back, because this is the first time we do this session. I really thank you for coming. You're our first batch. You saw a premiere show tonight, and we really hope it's been helpful. And we hope to offer this. We'll see how it goes. I mean, how many hits we get on the internet for that session. If we see there's an appetite for it, I'm thinking we'll offer it maybe twice a year before people apply, and in May or June, when there are a lot of people eager to understand why they were refused. So thank you, and I wish you the best of luck in applying if you are reapplying this term. And if there's anything we didn't answer, just a process question or anything that I didn't answer, we can be here for maybe 10 minutes now, and then you can come to the office or call the office. Thank you. Oh, hi. Yes, yes, yes. Nice to meet you. Okay, I'm glad. Was it helpful? Okay, good.